Hello, my magical friends. My name's Ayumi. My pronouns are she, her, hers. And you're listening to Sparkle Side Chats with Magical Girl Ayu. Whether it's your first or 162nd time listening, we welcome you to our space to celebrate magical girls from every corner of the world. We have some news, and I've watched and read some things, and then we'll get to today's topic. So let's get started. So first thing in the news is a bit of a shock. Last week, Tencent Animation Studio, based in China, which from my understanding, learning a lot from the past week, is a pretty big studio. They announced, along with Toei Animation, the project roughly being translated as Flower Fairy Magical Fragrance. So this is a continuation, a kind of a possible reboot slash remake slash sequel question mark of Hananoko Lun Lun from 1979. Now, this is not a Toei property that anyone expected to be getting a reboot anytime soon, but all we have right now is a teaser, trailer, and a poster. And in the poster, just to describe it for anyone who has not seen it yet, we have this beautiful stained glass image, which shows the titular Lun Lun from the original series. And next to her on the other side is Togenishia, who was the kind of rival character. You can listen to our episode on Lun Lun for deeper information, but essentially Togenishia was from the Fairy Kingdom and was following Lun Lun around in her adventures, trying to get the rainbow flower from her, which was what Lun Lun was seeking out. It is deeply implied in the original series that Togenishia is an older character than her, but what we do see in this new image are two girls in a kind of, not necessarily a typical school uniform, but in school uniforms. They are, again, just surrounded by gorgeous flowers, and we can see that one of them looks kind of like she could be like Lun Lun. She has kind of a dirty blonde hair and has blue eyes and is carrying some very light-colored staff, a ring, a bracelet, and has very light-colored socks as well to differentiate from the other girl, who has hair of a similar tone to Togenishia, right? A deeper red, and a lot of very similar items, but very kind of dark looking. You know, they're black and red. And she's wearing these like kind of candy striped socks. And, you know, nothing that we can really tell for sure. But based on this image, it's easy to presume that this might be the story of two girls who are the descendants of Lun Lun and Togenishia and are now fighting to get the rainbow flower once again. They're also leaning back against this perfume, or what seems to be perfume, so that might be where the fragrance aspect comes from. Again, this is a collaborative thing. We don't know anything else about when this will happen or anything like that, but of course, this is a series that no one saw a continuation of coming, so we're all very excited. In Magical Girl comic news, the magazine Comic Gene, which is a self-proclaimed boys comic magazine for female readers, for girl readers, they have launched a new series starting in their next issue, which is a Magical Girl series called Arukari Retose. So we don't know much about this series, but from the basic description, it's about a girl who isn't good at studies or exercise, very relatable. She develops a close relationship to the honor student at school, and their relationship changes when she obtains special powers. And the images we have, both in the cover of the magazine and the kind of cover of the series itself, we can see two magical girls, one with very, very large pink pigtails and a, you know, kind of heart-themed magical girl outfit, and the other one also has some heart stuff going on, but is more yellow and orange in color. This seems to be based on a Vocaloid song. I've heard of this happening before, where Vocaloid songs have ended up turning into entire concepts for original stories, which is kind of interesting in a way of adapting a work. But in any case, this is all we have for now. But it's pretty cool to get another Magical Girl series out there, so We'll see how this plays out. And last but certainly not least, we have some news about coming news. So, of course, we had heard a while back that the Madoka Magica franchise was going to get a continuation with a new film, and we had a teaser poster for it, and even a title as well. It's about Walpurgis Night, which is, you know, a kind of main staple name throughout the franchise, if you are aware of it. And it's going to be a continuation of the Rebellion story, the Rebellion film. So that was the news we had gotten. We had heard it would come out sometime this year, 2023. And then things have been quiet. Now, the franchise has been busy churning out all kinds of merchandise this year, but we didn't see anything related to the movies until this week, where we got the news that there would be coming news about said movie during Aniplex Online Fest 2023 on September 10th. So for anyone unaware of this event, this is a major event for Aniplex and gives us all kinds of information, lots of news drops at this time surrounding upcoming series. And the great thing about this is that it is an online, you know, kind of event. You know, there are panels and also on interviews and all kinds of cool things. And you can watch it streaming live. So it doesn't matter if you are overseas or right here in Japan, you can watch it. And I believe, depending on the event, they do often have live subtitling as well, because they understand the popularity of Japanese series all around the world. So that is where we're getting our news. So we know to wait until September 10th to get news about this movie. And that's all for news today. So let's go on to my consumption habits. So of course we watched Soaring Sky Prehere this week. And again, a very interesting episode. We got some, you know, interesting things going on with Ageha. Family is a very important part of this season in a lot of ways, so it's very interesting to see what happens when we get more information about different characters' families. And it's just a very cute, not super serious episode, but, you know, it's got its serious moments, so I enjoyed it, as I've been enjoying the whole season. Let's see, what's next? I have been watching more Kami Witch Lara. I am still not caught up or anything. I'm just a few more episodes in, but I have been enjoying it. It's, you know, surprisingly, despite the fact that I don't understand a word of Korean, I've been able to follow along roughly with what's going on in this little cartoon, and it's been a delight, and I've even gotten more people to watch along with me, so it's been really fun to see how other people are similarly reacting and so on. But yeah, so I've been, you know, because each episode is 15 minutes long, it's been very easy to kind of fit an episode or two into my day when I have the time. So I'm sure I will be finished in no time. And to reading habits. So I actually forgot to mention this last week, but I did get a hold of volume 3 of Mermaid Melody, Pitchy Pitchy Pitch Aqua. So now that I am doing more online comic reading on an official basis, I probably will start reading the comic online chapter by chapter. I'll definitely be able to let you know more quickly about my feelings about this story. But yeah, volume 3, honestly, as things are going, I am a little bored. It's, you know, I really, from the beginning, and I've said this before, I've wanted to be excited about this sequel and be excited about the story, but it just feels very, for the most part, quite, you know, unoriginal, uninteresting, you know, and it sucks because I really do want to love it. I think, you know, the only thing that's really going for me is the character of Sango, but Sango didn't really have a lot to do in this last chapter, or this last volume, I should say. And I think, I mean, I'm going to continue to buy each volume and read it as it comes out to support despite that. But it is, you know, frankly disappointing. I really do want this to be good, but I just feel myself cringing and just being like, oh, really? Are we doing this again? You know, it's been 20 years since the original story came out, and yet some of the plot points, the kind of major things are very much just recycled from the original material in a way that doesn't feel innovative in the slightest. So yeah, that's my disappointing thing there. But yeah, I think that's everything I have to mention this week. So with that, let's move on to today's topic. All right, so today is a subject that it was difficult to watch and difficult to talk about to a certain extent. Also, it had been difficult in the first place to even find a guest for the topic of Prisma Ilya. And of course, this is just the first season we're going to discuss today, so I do have to go find more people and get back to you on the rest of the franchise. But yeah, we're here. We're doing it finally. And it is a rough one. I think it is kind of infamous for its disturbing parts. And I think for me, I feel pretty strongly that if you are under the age of 18, this is a magical girl series that you should not be subjected to at all. I think, you know, you can listen in to this episode because we don't show you anything. But of course, we do have to talk about what the things are that are disturbing, which means I'm not necessarily 100% comfortable with you listening to this episode if you are a minor as well. Though it is safer, we do end up having to use some details, so I would prefer if you didn't hear it. But, you know, I can't stop you, of course, if you are under the age of 18, but I will put an explicit tag on this episode for that reason. Now, again, about finding a fan of this franchise to talk to, I was very lucky to be reminded that I have a friend, a Twitter mutual, that happens to be a fan of the Fate franchise in general and is someone that I know to be a good person, because one of the things about these kind of series is that it can be difficult to trust the fans. No offense if you are also in the Fate fandom. I understand, and I have learned also just from my guest herself that, you know, there are a lot of people who understand that things are problematic and wrong, and they're not for those aspects, but they enjoy the franchise for other reasons, and I respect that. That being said, there are still a lot of weirdos that, again, you know, there are weirdos everywhere, so there you have it. But yes, so getting into today's episode, I got to talk to Rin Fujikake, who is a really fun person to just talk to about nerd stuff. The main thing that I should point out that is really great about her is that she is a licensed kimono stylist. She is an expert. She knows what she's doing, and she's really good at it. So you can follow her online for that stuff in particular. But yeah, she is super cool, and I really had a lot of fun talking to her about this stuff and just learning so much about this fandom world that I still feel like I've barely scratched the surface of. But she does bring a lot of context that I think is super helpful. Getting into the warnings, again, if you are under 18, I highly recommend you don't listen to this episode, namely because this is a series that contains a lot of sexualization of minors. Very gross for that reason. There's also mention of incest in this series and in this episode's discussion. And oh, there's also some racism in this franchise. So there you have it. So yeah, and I know that these are all, again, scratching the surface. So those are things you should keep in mind if you try to watch the show for yourself. But also, you don't have to. You can just listen to this episode and decide after that if this is for you. Because, you know, there are some interesting things going on with this show. That's why I opted to keep it in the roster of things to talk about on this podcast, despite all its problems. So I would love for you to keep that in mind. Yeah, it is definitely quite an interesting section of this genre to get into. And of course, I will at some point get into the rest of it. So we'll see what happens there. If you know any other people who are cool, who happen to be a fan of this franchise, I would be happy to hear their names. But yeah, so I think I've rambled for long enough. So let's get into our chat with my friend Nadine about Fate Collide Liner Prisma Ilia Season 1. We are here today to talk about Fate Collide Liner Prisma Ilia from 2013, the first season of the Prisma Ilia franchise, which has somehow passed its 10-year anniversary. And I'm very delighted about today's guest. Can you please introduce yourself?
Hello, everybody. My name is Rin. You can find me at Mainichi Kimono, where I am a kimono stylist and teacher. And I have been with the Fate fandom, I guess you could say, for goodness, since 2008. I used to run a blog with a friend called Incorrect Fate Quotes, which was born in the era of Tumblr, where they had like the incorrect like Les Mis quotes, incorrect Phantom quotes, etc., etc. And we got kind of big for a while, which was a little terrifying, but it was all in good fun. I'm still kind of part of Fate. I don't really participate that much anymore, but I'm sure I will buy the new game that's coming out later this year.
Yeah. I still don't know a lot about this franchise, so you'll definitely be helping me out today with that. But before we get into that, because this is still a Magical Girl series, Dean, what is your history with the Magical Girl genre?
As a young girl, I was, of course, super into Sailor Moon. I think that was my first big obsession when I was younger. I have to unfortunately admit that outside of Sailor Moon, I haven't really gotten into a whole lot, but I've gone very deep into Sailor Moon. Like, I was really big into actually the live action, the Pretty Guardian Sailor Moon. I loved that one, even though like the Monster of the Week was kind of a little cheesy, but hey, it is what it is.
Sure.
But I grew up with Sailor Moon especially. I have like family members and students, of course, who are into Precure. And just in general, I don't know that much. I know a little bit of Cardcaptor Sakura, but I mean, does Fushigi Yugi count? I don't think it does.
That's an adjacent series. Like, there, you know, it's got magic, it's fantasy, but it's not quite a Magical Girl series. But definitely,
yeah, I was
like,
gonna say, yeah, what like, counts?
Sure. Yeah, but you know, it's quite a interesting kind of like basis before we get into this series, because in a lot of ways, it is definitely mostly taking from Cardcaptor Sakura's kind of system, and definitely also a lot of Lyrical Nanoha, which is the other, those two kind of franchises especially go hand in hand, as Nanoha was also a parody of Cardcaptor Sakura back in the day, but it's also famously the other Magical Girl series that is a spinoff from an erotic game. So it's got that weird thing in common, though it is very different in a lot of ways. I think like the origins are both the same, but I think like that having that kind of gap, the Fate franchise being like a little bit different from the Triangle Heart series that Nanoha came from, I think there's a little bit more, actually no, there's a lot more extreme stuff going on in Prisma Ilia, which we will get to later. but since it's also relevant to, this conversation, what is your relationship to Prisma Ilia and the Fate franchise, like, as it relates to the Fate franchise?
I originally got into Prisma Ilia because, obviously, the connections with Fate. I was very interested to see these alternate versions of the characters, because Ilia and Prisma Ilia and Ilia and the main Fate are very different in many ways. The fandom would probably refer to Ilia as some type of like murderous loli, and she can be very cold and exacting in what she wants, while of course still being childlike, because you know, stock loli character from the early 2000s, which is something that I think a lot of people forget when they're new to the series, whether it's normal Fate or Prisma Ilia, that it's still a franchise that started in 2004, and it's going to come with the same tropes and what was considered popular or iconic or whatever from that time period. So having that in mind, watching Ilya's character totally change was definitely fascinating. To go to this seemingly normal girl, who obviously is not normal because she's the protagonist and a magical girl, but still, it was kind of bittersweet. Also, if you're familiar with Fate, Ilya has a very tragic backstory. So seeing her have a kind of a normal family almost made you think, oh man, this is the happiness that maybe she could have gotten. Not to say that nothing weird or wacky or devastating happens in Prilia, but even at the very beginning, seeing her have a normal family was definitely a bit of a throw off in a good way.
Interesting. Yeah. I'm definitely curious. Do you have any inkling as to why they would choose this character to have a magical girl spinoff for?
If you're going to base it off of Cardcaptor Sakura, I think it makes sense because Ilya is the youngest. In the original Fate, she's actually older than Shiro. She's just a lowly I can never pronounce this word, a homunculus.
Okay.
So she's actually the older sister, which is spoiler, I guess. She just looks younger. But in this incarnation, she's genuinely a elementary school student, which also threw me off a little bit, but that's to be expected because it's supposed to be like her in the quote-unquote real world versus Fate, which is so many high stakes and pressures on to summon the Holy Grail and whatnot. So I think that's a big thing there too, is you have Ilya actually being the age she looks.
That's interesting. I mean, that kind of explains a little bit about her character, because there are a lot of things about her and how she seems to think about stuff, especially like in a gross way, that feel like they're treating her like she's older than she is, but that context is very helpful, so thank you. Yeah. I remember when this series like first started to come out and people were talking about it. Of course, it was like 2013. This is right after like Madoka blew up as far as seinen magical girl shows. So a lot of people were kind of like making the obvious comparison to that. But it also like felt like right away that it was very different. I think even just like the way the very first episode opens up kind of shows how different it is, and because of the source material. And like at this point, you know, Nanoha had been around for over a decade itself, and Nanoha was another series where, you know, even though it did start from this this erotic game, like it just became its own thing that's like way bigger than the rest of its what it came from. So it was really interesting to see that like this seems to be very big. Like it definitely has a separate fandom, and even though there isn't anything coming out right this very moment. I know there was a movie, I think, 2 or 3 years ago now. And there's still a lot of stuff going on with this franchise. And it feels like it's a little bit more active than Fate, but I'm also not sure because I'm not, like, in the Fate fandom. That's just kind of my cultural osmosis, like, what I seem to be getting from it, if that makes sense. So to get into the actual story, so like we said, you know, this is very Cardcaptor Sakura-like, though I kind of like the way it opens. It's very different in that we start off with these two other characters, Rin, also Rin. My understanding is you use the name Rin online because of this Rin, right?
Yeah, actually, it is from that Rin originally. It was just a nod to that, a inside joke that went too far, and now I'm stuck with it. But yes, sure. That was really what made me get into Fate to begin with, was Rin's character. Long story short, way back in the day, somebody made a joke that I was tsundere, and I looked at the TV Tropes page, because TV Tropes is, you know, the beginning of a gigantic rabbit hole that you spend hours on, like clicking on Wikipedia links and then realizing that you've been there for 2 hours. Rin was on that picture. Maybe she still is the picture for that trope. Because I was just like, I wonder what people in English say about tsundere. So I looked and I was like, oh, okay, there's that character. I don't know who she is. And then just out of curiosity, I read the manga and then I played the game, the visual novel. And then the anime came out, the Dean anime. And then the UFO table. I cannot pronounce anything in any language anymore. The cooler, so to speak, adaptations of Fates came out in the 2010s with the shiny animation, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. And just, yeah, that is where the name Rin came from for me. But long story short, actually, I'll never forget. It was Silverlink, I think, are the people who did Prismalia. And a lot of people online got into big fights because Silverlink did a really great job animating a lot of the fight scenes.
Yeah.
And immediately there was this tension, like, oh, who animated the UFOtable? I mean, who animated the fight scenes better, UFOtable or Silverlink? And, like, it became this, in my opinion, unnecessary, like, fight online over, like, which animation studio was better for Fate as a whole. And to me, I felt like, well, Prismalia is so uniquely its own thing. It doesn't have to be UFOtable. Why can't it be another studio? But that's a whole other bag of worms.
That makes sense. Yeah, I think the animation was pretty good for the series. It was definitely very fun to watch. But yeah, so we start off the series, start off episode one, we see this magical battle, a kind of classic magic battle between Rin and Luvia, who are very clearly and similarly matched in abilities, and they both have like magic wands that are very, you know, magical girl-esque, and they're using these cards to attack each other, but they're so busy fighting that both of their magic wands, who are, we come to learn later, are named Ruby and Sapphire, are just fed up with them and leave and decide they're going to go find new masters to go on this mission because they can't get anything done with these two constantly bickering. So I thought that was a really funny kind of opening to start this series. And we do meet Ilya, who is this, you know, very cute little elementary school girl. I believe she's supposed to be in the fourth or fifth grade. And she, you know, is having kind of like a fairly normal day at school. There's mentioned of like her family are there. She gets into a fight with her sister because her sister is watching her favorite Magical Girl series before she can, you know, because like the delivery came today for the DVD or whatever. It's very exciting for her. So just like a very, very, you know, ordinary life, like you said. And it's at the very end of that day when it's time for her bath that Magical Ruby, the kind of red wand, shows up. And of course, it's already very awkward and we'll get into the way that that is set up. But essentially, it ends up convincing her, telling her what to do in order to make her into a magical girl. It's a little bit, just a little bit, like, not actually in a consensual way, which is also kind of gross. But in the end, she, you know, transforms and she kind of is like, oh, okay, I guess this is really kind of weird, but okay. And then Rin shows up just a little bit too late because, you know, the contract has been sealed between Ruby and Ilya. And so now Ruby has a new master, basically. But Rin decides to take her on and make her, you know, help her to, you know, complete their mission, which is to collect these class cards who are, they're these like very, very powerful cards that they have to defeat and capture. So very similar again to Card Captor Sakura. And they find out by the next episode that Luvia also is in the same position where she was a little bit too late and her wand, Sapphire, chose Miyu. And we get a little bit more information and context for that in particular, but Miyu is also very good at being a magical girl. And so it looks like they're now this kind of group of four where Rin and Luvia can still do some magic, but they can't do the full magical girl thing anymore. So they need these two to kind of do what they can't. I'm very curious about like how much you could follow the tropes, the magical girl tropes in the series as someone who has only watched like mostly just Sailor Moon and is like kind of vaguely aware of other shows.
You reminded me of Madoka, and I have to admit, yes, I have seen that. I can't believe I forgot that. I watched that and the trauma from that show. But yeah, I think for me as a Fate fan, I was more interested to see how they were being interpreted in magical girl things. Of course, there's the big transformation sequence, because what is a magical girl show without a transformation sequence? And everything being as cute as possible, while still being, of course, effective in fighting, I guess you could say. I was prepared for the magical girl elements to, I guess you could say, be too much going away from Fate, that they wouldn't actually connect with, like, Nasuverse at all. And I was pleasantly surprised to see that I was wrong. Like, having the cards be, like, class cards that summon the same servants, it felt to me like its own story. It was clearly a magical girl story that was still also calling back to Fate Stay Night in the best possible way. And a lot of people might disagree with me on this, but I do think it stands alone in that regard, that it has enough magical girl aspects, like the wand, the transformation, the big emphasis on friendship, which, I mean, mm-hmm. you've seen way more magical girl stuff than I have, but I do think the importance of friendship and the camaraderie with that is a big thing with magical girl shows overall. And I think that's an element we couldn't really explore in Fate Stay Night, given how, you know, high the stakes were for other things. And I would argue, like, found family is more of something that we see in Fate Stay Night in particular than we would in, like, some sort of magical girl show. So it's kind of nice to see the emphasis on friendship and, of course, believing in yourself. Ilya has a very strong imagination, and that helped her a lot. But me was very much more logical. If I'm remembering correctly, that enabled Ilya to fly, and Miu couldn't quite fly. And I thought that was really interesting, to have belief be such a strong aspect. Because, like, in Sailor Moon, we, like, there's moments where the characters, of course, like, oh my god, I can't believe that I'm Sailor Mars or whoever I may be. But we didn't have that element of, I need to literally believe in my imagination and use my imagination as a tool to get things done. Which I don't know if that's in other magical girl shows, but given the elements of what magic is supposed to be, like a miracle, basically, beyond what science can explain, I guess you could say, having that be so important towards harnessing your magical ability, I thought that was very cool, especially given the differences in Miu and Ilya's dynamic.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, found family is something that can happen sometimes in magical girls, but friendship is definitely, like, a stronger force. And then as far as the magic rules, yeah, like you said, like, Ilya doesn't even think about it. She's like, well, I'm a magical girl now, so of course I can fly, which is very cute. I think that can be true sometimes. It depends on the series. Like, magic rules can vary a lot from show to show. But I would say that it was a very interesting aspect. But sorry, can you explain how the magic system in this relates to the Fate Stay Night magic system? Because I didn't even know that there was a connection.
Oh boy. So in the original Fate Stay Night, you have the Holy Grail War, and you have seven servants. And each servant is a legendary hero. So you've got, like, Hercules, Medusa. So I guess not necessarily heroes, but also villains, I guess. Legendary figures. Mythological figures. And they've been summoned through time to come and fight for the Holy Grail. And each servant has a master. And so a master will make a contract with the servant. And so there's an emotional significance if you're coming from Fate with watching some of these battles, because you know the background and the identity of these servants from the original story. And that makes, I think, an impact that, if you're not familiar with Fate, and you're saying, oh, okay, that's kind of cool. They've summoned King Arthur. Oh, that's kind of cool. They've summoned so-and-so. It's not going to have the same impact as if you knew, like, what role did these characters genuinely play in the original story? Because each of these characters have their own abilities, because each servant has their special weapon. Like, King Arthur has Excalibur, for example. And each weapon has a backstory, like in the original myth, of course, as well as that character's canon within Fate Stay Night. So instead of course, having it where you're summoning the servants with Holy Grail, it's, at least in the first season, you have these servants are kind of, their essence is in the cards. And so you can kind of like install the essence, I guess you could say, into what you're doing. And which is, of course, a unique way of interpreting how the Holy Grail War was fought in the original Fate series.
Very interesting. I did not realize that, but that makes a lot of sense. So thank you for that explanation. So yeah, I guess, shall we continue more into the actual stories now that we have our main characters and all that? So, you know, episode three, the kind of classic thing happens where Miyu transfers to Ilya's school, and they kind of like talk about their roles as magical girls. And she tells Ilya that, you know, she doesn't really have a reason to be a magical girl, so she shouldn't really have to fight. You know, like, obviously insinuating that Miyu does have a reason. We don't know what that could be, but there you have it. And, you know, we get, like, at least a little bit of a battle in every episode. Most of the battles do go for more than one, depending, and, of course, the battles do escalate over time. But yeah, episode four kind of really teaches more about the battle system. And like you said, that's where we get, you know, Ilya realizing that she can fly. Literally no problem. It has not even occurred to her that she wouldn't be able to fly. But Miyu does not have that same, you know, belief, that same inspiration. They even go so far as to have Miyu go to Ilya's house to watch Magical Girls with her, and she still doesn't quite get it, because, like, that's fiction.
Yeah.
You know, basically, just, like, it's the idea of getting notions from a TV show is absurd to her, which is kind of cute. But still, you know, she's able to figure out her own way. Even though she can't fly, she learns to kind of create these platforms that she uses to kind of bounce around in the air. So even though she doesn't figure out the exact same ability as Ilya, she's able to manifest a different ability to fight. So yeah, it was just like a really, just a constant like thing throughout this season, that like what they think they can do is very important to what they can do. You know, it's very, very literal in that way. But yeah, and then it's at the end of this episode that we get introduced to a new enemy who's, you know, very, very powerful and mysterious. And because they had just finished fighting off the caster card, they are quite weak. And Nina and Luvia do come back as magical girls in this episode, which is a lot of fun. Theirs are, like, especially silly because they have, like, is it both cat ears and a cat tail? Like, it's very, very...
Yes, they do.
Very interesting, very different. I don't know how those designs read as a Fate fan, because of course these characters are all in Fate, but in Fate Stay Night rather. But it is, you know, just a lot of silliness, and there's like constant jokes made pretty much at all these girls' expenses about how being a magical girl, part of it is having an embarrassing costume. Certainly they all have very different costumes, but it's very interesting to see them finally have to come back and, you know, talk to Ruby and Sapphire and be like, hey, you know, the girls are down. We need to defeat this thing, so let's go. Now, unfortunately, in episode six, they do get defeated after all, and they kind of all get trapped, and Ilya is feeling very much like she's feeling quite defeated, and she's really worried about protecting Miyu as well, because she doesn't want Miyu to get hurt anymore. And she kind of like breaks a little, and she uses one of the cards, but in a different way than they had been doing, which was like putting it over their magic wand and like saying include or install later on. But here she just straight up like seems to completely embody the card in this way, and she doesn't even have any memory of it after the fact, but she was quite powerful. And it was like so much energy, so much magic energy that she passes out. And when she wakes up, she thinks that Miyu is the one that had defeated their enemy. But yeah, and then episode seven is a kind of cute episode and then also very not cute episode. The idea of it is very cute, where Ilya is just home with a fever. And, you know, we get like a kind of normal day episode where it's, you know, about not doing any magical girl stuff, at least at the beginning. But things get weird pretty quickly, which we will talk about later. At that point, at the very end of this episode is like kind of the next battle where, you know, Ilya is actually still a bit weakened from the last attack. And this time around, she gets poisoned. And in everyone's attempts to get to her while she's about to be attacked because she's been weakened, she creates another really powerful blast. And Miu is just barely able to protect herself and Rin and Luvia. And it's here that she tells Ilya, like, she can't fight with her anymore. They cannot fight alongside. So she needs to give up because, yeah, it's too much to see her fail all the time. And, of course, Ilya being very upset, she leaves. Oh, by the way, I know I'm just, like, saying the plot, but if you have any comments about any of the stuff that's happening in these episodes, please feel free to, like, say anything.
You're good. Don't worry.
Okay. So yeah, episode 8, you know, now there's all this tension between Ilya and Miu, you know, because of their fight and what have you. They still both are going to school, but everyone can tell something has happened and they're kind of refusing to talk to each other. Well, Ilya's kind of too afraid to talk to Miu, but yeah, Miu is just like not talking to Ilya. And she's also being very rude to the other girls in the class. And yeah, just like a really, really rough day for them. And, you know, Ilya's very upset because they had just seemingly become friends. Like, they had gone so far as to kind of like drop honorifics with each other, which is a very big deal in a friendship. And now all of this had happened and she doesn't really understand. But at the very end of this episode, her mother comes home. So in episode 9, we see that Miu has gone with Rin and Luvia. And by the way, Ruby is still with Ilya because Ruby's like, well, you never know when you're going to need to be a magical girl. And I'm still contracted to you. You're my master. So this is fine. So now it's just the three of them going to fight the final card, who is incredibly powerful and also can regenerate basically as soon as he's killed. So kind of makes it a bit of an impossible battle.
Yeah, because he's got what's called 9 lives. Mm-hmm. So with Berserker, because Hercules had 9 trials in his life. So in the original Fates Day Night, his noble phantasm was pretty much like he could revive himself 9 times.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, that's why he was able to come back and keep coming back.
I see. So
sorry for interrupting.
No, please. It's okay. It's very important information in context. So yeah, that's, you know, that's kind of like where things are headed off. And, you know, this being a shorter series with only 10 episodes, 9 and 10 are kind of our finale. And 9 is a very sweet episode with Ilya and her mother, more or less. Every time that, like, there's a really nice moment, there's, like, a huge asterisk on it, which we'll get to later. But in general, as far as the written context, it's very cute in which she is, you know, trying to work out talking about her feelings about her friend to her mom, who's, like, home at her. It's, I believe both of her parents, like, work abroad. So, yeah, like, her coming home was, like, a big deal. And, yeah, they're, like, you know, they're bonding and all that. And it's very fun that she's, like, trying to explain what's going on without actually saying she's a magical girl. The way that, like, it goes is just, like, oh, yeah, I had a falling out with my friend Miu. She's not very good at expressing herself. And, you know, she's very quiet, but I kind of failed her, and now I want to be stronger for her, but she has said that, like, I can't be. And her mother is the one who's like, hey, you just said that she's not good at communicating, so I think she's just trying to protect you, and she's not really pushing you away. She just, like, wants you to be safe and all that. So, you know, with that realization, mm-hmm. she realizes that, like, oh, this is all friendship. and she decides to go and help out Miu in the final fight, which is very good because Miu was pretty much just about to die. And yeah, they're able to, like, just have this really, really epic battle and, you know, believe in each other, believe in the cards, and finally defeat the monster together. And all seems well, especially because they've collected all the class cards, which means for Rin and Luvia, they can finally leave because they're not from around here. Except that in the last episode, Rin gets the call that, actually no, they really need to stay in Japan for a year because they don't have any sense. Like, they need to, like, study social behavior, I guess, is the implication.
Basically, it's a punishment. Like their behavior has been so atrocious that they haven't earned their way back to Clock Tower. So a little background about Rin in the original verse. So she is Japanese, of course. I mean, Tosaka Rin. But Clock Tower, which is supposed to be like the very big center of all things magical and mystical, is in London. And that's where Rin and Luvia are studying. So the Pi are not going to talk about this in Prilia, but Rin and Luvia are cousins, actually.
Oh.
So Rin, I believe, is 3/4 Japanese, 1/4 Finnish. And I guess there was, in the Third Holy Grail War, this is original canon, there were 2 sisters from the Edelfelt family that were sent to fight in the Holy Grail War. They got defeated, and the head of the Tosaka family ended up marrying one of the Edelfelt sisters. And that was Rin's father, and Rin's father is half Japanese.
Hmm.
And then Rin's father married a Japanese woman, so that makes Rin 3/4 Japanese. But the center of the world, magic-wise, is Clock Tower, which is in London. And so for anyone who's a mage, the idea is like a place like Japan, which is so far away from Clock Tower, is like very country bumpkin, not that great, bleh. Our magic is superior than yours because you guys are weird foreigners kind of thing. And that's one big reason why Luvia looks down upon Rin.
Hmm.
Because she is classy European fufufu odosama. And in the original series, I believe they end up, I have not read Hal Ataraxene so long, but if my memory serves, they were supposed to have the same room, or they accidentally booked the same dorm room, and that started their rivalry, and they've hated each other ever since. And so this rivalry is obviously repeated here in Prilia, and they've been fighting each other for so long and have hated each other for so long that they're being forced to continue to work together in order to make them more mature, capable mages who can actually, I guess you could say, be the heiresses that they need to be and be the prodigies they're supposed to be in magecraft. So that's why they're being forced to stay in Japan. So it's kind of like a throwback to the original Fate here, that they're still fighting, they're still bickering, they're always going to, and this is just kind of another way to force them to put up with each other and maybe become friends themselves.
Okay, that's really interesting, and I did not know that about Dean in particular, so that is useful context for later as well. But it kind of felt like one of those rivalries that like is kind of forever, but that's interesting that they're cousins. That does change things a little bit. I guess with the ending all wrapped up here, like, I guess what thoughts do you have about like the first season in general, not just as a Magical Girl series, also as like a Fate series, etc.? Because I think, like, for the most part, when you get to the core of the show, it's definitely, you know, being a classic Magical Girl series, it's very much got all the good tropes, the fun tropes, the friendship, the love, the subtext. And it's like really, really, I think, like, yeah, on its surface, it can be enjoyed. Like, it's nice on paper, and I think that, you know, I found myself enjoying more episodes than I didn't. But yeah, what are your thoughts on it?
From a Fate fan point of view, I think it's very good, in that we have its own canon established. It's not just a parody. Even though at first the enjoyable part, especially the first season, is it is a parody while still, of course, establishing its own canon. And it doesn't take itself too seriously. And then around, like, I would argue the end of season two, beginning of season three, which we haven't seen yet, it starts to take itself very, very seriously. So it's kind of like a dip in a pool that you don't know has piranhas in it. And I don't mean as an insult. I mean, it's just like you're not prepared for how deep and how dark it's going to get. And it does. It definitely does. So if you enjoyed it, I do encourage watching the other seasons. I do think that because this is still Nasuverse, the deeper they go into the story, the more complicated the world becomes, which is typical for Nasu. The Nasuverse is so convoluted and everywhere when it comes to the background of magic and how it works within Fate, and it's constantly changing. I don't think Fate Grand Order, which of course is the mobile game that had an arcade game that's now getting closed down here in Japan, but that's another story. They added a lot more lore and whatnot on top of it, so it's just, Nasuverse is just massive at this point. And Prisma Ilia is the beginning of another form of massive that is both drawing from the original canon and also becoming its own thing. And so this is a great introduction. It goes at a good pace, I'd say. Because with normal Fate Stay Night, you're kind of tossed in, which, that's normal. It's based on a book. I mean, a visual novel is still a book in many regards. And if you read the original novel, there's so much info dumping. It's like, whoa, oh my god. So it can be very confusing. But with Prisma Ilia, because the concepts have been kind of, I don't want to say dumbed down, but they are simplified because it reflects the audience, the potential audience, I guess you could say, of, you know, elementary school girl gets magical wand friend thing, and now they're looking for magical cards. That premise isn't in and of itself, even if it's done uniquely, is still, you know, a very simple thing versus, here's this ancient war that people have been fighting for the past however many centuries, and by the way, here's this entire world of magic that ordinary people don't know about, with different levels and rules and designations, and oh my god, and Nasuverse itself is not confined to Fate Stay Night. You also have Tsukihime, you have Witch on the Holy Night, which all of which have their own canon, but it's still connected to the same magical verse. Like, in many ways, it feels like a comic book, like an American comic book in that regard, where if you try to read everything on Wikipedia, it will A, help, but B, give you a headache. It's very complicated. So I'm not surprised that the first season was, you know, light and fun and established its own canon. And then eventually, because it is a Nasuverse thing, becomes absolutely nuts. And again, it is worth it, but it is complicated. Even Prisma Ilia can become very complicated. So fair warning.
Yeah, for sure. I think I do like that I was able to, you know, enjoy the show for what it was with zero knowledge of Fate. That means it's telling a good story, right? Because if I have to do homework in order to understand a parody, then it's certainly, I don't think it's a very good thing. I think it's very important that a show like this does stand on its own. And it's like, okay, if I want to go through and figure out what else is going on in the series, I can go do my homework, but I don't need it. It's that supplementary material at this point. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But yeah, with that, I guess we should dive into the problematic corner, which is a very, it's not even a, it's a whole room in this case. It's a very, very big part of the series.
Yes.
So, you know, like you kind of already hinted at it a little bit with like identifying Ilia as a lowly type character. So even though she is, I mean, she is literally an elementary school student in this series, but even regardless of that, she was otherwise like this girl who looks very young and has a very squeaky high voice and is very childlike. And this series has a lot of, I don't want to say like fun, but like it is doing a lot with just sexualizing her all over the place.
Oh, good lord, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, like I said, her magical girl adventure begins when she's in the bath. So, like, she's talking to Magical Ruby while she's naked. At one point, she kind of, like, panics and turns off the light in order to kind of see what's going on outside. And in so doing, her brother, Shido, does go to take a bath himself and doesn't know that she's there. And so it's like this kind of shocking moment. And he ends up like slipping on something and like passing. He gets knocked out. And there's also, yeah, the whole incest plot line with Ilya and her brother Shido. And I don't quite understand what's going on there as far as like how that relates to the original series. But like at the very least...
Okay.
She clearly has, like, a crush on her brother, which is already weird, but it's also very clearly seen as being, like, semi-sexual as well, because, like, as part of kind of getting Ilya riled up, Ruby, like, lifts Shido's towel while he's knocked out, and we don't see anything, but she does, and she's freaking out and blushing all over the place, and it's like, what is going on? I remember the first time I actually tried to start watching this series a while ago, you know, for knowledge of Magical Girl franchises, etc. And I found it so hard to get into the first time. I, like, gave up after episode two because this intro was so wild. And it's interesting because, like, for a while after this, things are pretty normal and, like, not weird for a long time. But this opening was absolutely wild. Yeah.
Yeah, completely. I was ready for some of it because of the original visual novel.
Mm-hmm.
So, I guess, for background, Shido was adopted in the original canon by Kitetsugu, who is Ilya's father.
Hmm.
Long story short, in the original canon, they never really knew each other until Ilya came to Japan for the Holy Grail War. She wanted revenge against Kitetsugu for not being there, for what she thought was him, like, disappearing, giving up on the family. That's a whole other can of worms that's... Anyway, in this canon, we have them actually together as a full family, with presumably Shido still being adopted.
Hmm.
And if he is still the adopted brother, then it's not, I guess you could say, straight incest, but it's still pretty incestual. Mm-hmm. And in the original Fate Stay Night, we have three routes. We have Fate Route, Unlimited Blade Works, and then we have Heaven's Feel. And in the original Fate Route, Ilya does capture Shido, and she's like, I want you to be mine, and it's kind of like, oh, wow, okay, she's sitting on his lap, what's going on here, oh my god. Like, I remember being like, what the heck, when I first read the visual novel myself. And it's not revealed that Ilya has a relationship with Kitetsugu, that he is her father, until... later, and like the emotional impact of that hits very high in the final route that you play in Heaven's Feel.
Hmm.
But basically, like, Kitetsugu never told Shido about his family. He never told Shido about Ilya, Iris Veil, none of it. He was pretty much kept in the dark. Which, depending on your point of view, Kitetsugu is a parent. Long story short, that's why, like, you have, like, this good emotional impact of seeing them together as a family in Prismalia, and then you also have the, oh, okay, I guess they're gonna carry over the weird relationship that Ilya had and make it a legit crush. And I, oh god, what bothered me, and I can't remember if this is season one or not, you'll have to confirm, but when Iris Feel even has photos of Shido to give to Ilya. And I was like, come on, don't, like, are you really encouraging your own daughter with your adopted son? Like, that's, okay, all right, this is a thing that's happening.
Yeah, goodness, I can't remember if that is in season one. There was definitely some weirdness, like, all around. You know, it doesn't come up a lot, but when it does, it's very clear that Ilya knows it's, like, wrong to have a crush on her brother, like, adopted or otherwise. And the other thing was, like, the kind of peak of it was in the final episode where she's dreaming about her brother and, like, dreaming about getting a reward. And so in her dream, she kisses him, and then she wakes up, and it turns out she kissed Miu on the lips by accident, and Miu is freaking out because Miu kind of seems to have a little bit of a crush on Ilya.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, Ilya, like, freaking out was like, oh, no, no, I was dreaming about kissing my brother. And then realized that sounded terrible and freaked out even more. It's kind of this kind of have your cake and eat it too thing where it's like they wanted to keep that, I guess, from the original for some reason. And I don't know. I guess I don't understand it being necessary, I guess, in the first place. Like, the fact that this has happened in more than one Magical Girl series in terms of, like, the full canon of the show is, like, very weird to me. But this has happened at least in one other show. But it's, like, this whole thing of, like, the you know, having a relationship with someone, having a romance with someone, and then it's, like, oh, it turns out we were actually kind of related. This is not weird, I guess. Like, I don't understand why people like that trope, but it, like, is a trope. So, yeah. It just, like, felt so unnecessary. Like, luckily, it's not super present, right? It doesn't come up a lot. So, like, it's, like, it really hits you in the very beginning and it hits you a little bit at the end. But for the most part, you could almost forget about it because it, like, he doesn't even show up for most of the show. Like, I think he's only in episode 1 and episode 10, basically. So, it's kind of a little bit forgettable, but, like, they still keep it in there, I guess, for the Fate fans. I just don't understand. And then, like, likewise with the continued sexualization of Ilya, you know, the kind of big one other than episode 1, where she's literally, like, naked or just covered in a towel, is episode 7. So when she's, you know, sick at home, that's when she finds out that Ruby and Sapphire can kind of communicate almost as if by the internet or something. And Ruby's able to project what Sapphire can see. And it turns out that Sapphire is currently able to see Miu wearing a maid costume. And Ilya gets very excited about this and, you know, begs Miu to come over. And she does. And it becomes this weird thing of, like, Ilya kind of also fetishizing Miu as a maid. I don't really understand what they were going for there, but that's the thing that happened. To the point where she's, like, asking her to call her master because she liked the sound of it and, like, saying, like, oh, this is so cute. And then, like, her caretaker, who I think is also her sister, gets weird about this, too. It's, I don't know, there's a lot happening in this episode.
There's a lot happening in this show.
Yeah. And then, like, another aspect of it was, like, in her desire to go through, like, the maid experience, she was, like, she, like, suddenly just takes off all her pajamas until she's wearing nothing but underwear and, like, jumps onto Miu. And then her friends show up from after school because school is over. They're like, hey, we just came to check up on you because you're sick. And they see Ilya half naked on top of Miu, who's wearing a maid costume. And they're like, oh, okay, we're gonna go now. Bye. It was a lot.
Yeah, I remember that.
So much. Just why?
It's hard because, like, I fully admit that I just kind of was like, okay, this is weird, so what's happening. And I tried to watch it for more of, like, the other parts of the plot. Like, I felt like it was very much so supposed to be, like, played for laughs. Mm-hmm. And it's not my sense of humor.
Yeah.
It probably never will be. But it's definitely a trope that's, like you mentioned, like, it's quite, like, this kind of, like, sexualizing humor is pretty common in a lot of media from that time period. And so, like, if you read the manga is true to its time, and I guess they sort of kept it in the anime. You know, I don't remember what year the manga came out, but I remember it being at least, I think, 5 years before the anime came out. So I would say, like, maybe late 2000s?
Yeah. I believe it started in 2007.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. I'm not crazy. But I definitely think that, like, when I think back on things that, for example, that I watched back in 2004, that I went, ah, haha, that's kind of weird, but okay. And then now that I'm, you know, older and we have shifted the dynamic of discourse a little bit, it's like, oh, okay, actually, that's, whew, wow, all right. But, you know, with the animators, I don't know why they keep it, but they do. And it is what it is, I suppose.
Yeah, would you say that as far as like the source material that it was pretty one for one? Because I didn't really check to see if there were any adjustments or
Yes.
yeah.
Yes. I mean, with some stuff like the scenes where they were like kind of sexualizing, I would say it was like a single panel in the manga. That was kind of like, haha, okay, awkward, but haha. At least for me, awkward. But then like in the anime, they kind of dialed it up a little bit more for extra. But other than that, it was pretty one to one in many respects. So if you want to enjoy Prisma Ilia, knowing that that stuff is there, but you don't want to see it as amplified, I would say check out the manga.
That makes sense. Yeah. I think it's so difficult to like recommend the series because I do feel like there are some good elements to it. I think overall it was not bad. It's just that the bad parts are really bad. So
Yes.
it's just, yeah, it just becomes like this, tablespoon of salt you have to share with people. Like it's really bad. It just becomes exhausting. And then I guess one more thing I wanted to point out that I noticed, it's I guess technically small in the grand scheme of all the problematic elements of the series, but it did stick out to me anyway. So, Ilia, we didn't like mention, she does have very light hair. She has like rabbit red eyes. She has like she's very clearly kind of presenting as very foreign coded, but she is actually half Japanese. And there is a scene where she's kind of just like relaxing. I can't remember if she's taking a bath or not. I think she is. And she talks about how she's so happy that she was born Japanese. And then Ruby is the one of all characters to be like, "Oh, but you're half." And it's like, what does this have to do with anything going on right now in this conversation? Like, she's still Japanese. And then it's just like, oh, imagine finally getting to be a magical girl and your magical partner turns out to be racist. Like, what is going on? It was just so rough. And yeah, just very disappointing to have as a comment to be made at all. It's very unnecessary.
Definitely. I mean, I know you feel me here. I feel you here too, being mixed. But the groan that I made, I was just like, really? Really? And like for me, when she said that, I was really happy because in the original, like Ilia is from where the Einzburn family is. She's never been to Japan before, and she's looking down on like Rin for being a like I guess he's like a backwards bumpkin. So to have her go, "Yeah, I'm so happy to be Japanese," and I'm like, "Oh yes, finally!" And then right away, Ruby makes that comment. I'm like, "Oh come on! Like we made progress, and you kicked in the face."
Yeah, that's a very interesting difference between
Yeah.
like, yeah.
It's just very exasperating because like I understand why within Nasuverse Japan is considered backwards because again it's far away from Clock Tower and there's a very Eurocentric like fascination with I wouldn't say it's as bad as like certain franchises that will not be named that named their magical school Mahotokoro. But there is definitely, despite this being a Japanese franchise, there is very much so a lot of the elements they've borrowed for making their magical system. They can be pretty Eurocentric in certain regards, because like Clock Tower is considered the best. But that doesn't mean there's not other organizations, because I do believe there is one in the Middle East. But Clock Tower is like the most powerful. And so people who are trained at Clock Tower do look down upon like people who are further away from Clock Tower's influence, which again can be argued as being Eurocentric in some ways. But I think it's just because of like the whole mystery idea of these rich, powerful people who of course have to be from Europe. Where else would they be from? They're rich and they're powerful and they have fancy dresses. They're European. Like, which is, I would say, overall an anime trope in general, but I think you get the idea.
Yeah, that Eurocentrism is somehow very Japanese. I definitely understand that.
Yeah, it's kind of weird to explain, but I think you know what I mean.
Yes. Is there anything else you wanted to kind of talk about as far as the series you were mentioning before about like kind of like the difference between the battles and stuff like that between this show and like Fate Stay Night or just other Fate series in general?
Again, like the first season's very easy to understand with the battles, but there is a certain character who I won't give too much background, but he is a version of Shiro.
Hmm.
And out of all the versions of Shiro that we have throughout Fate Stay Night as a whole franchise, a lot of people say he's their favorite.
Huh.
And I can see why. I can't really dive into details as to why not, because if you get that far, A, it's really complicated to explain, and B, it is very cool to experience it raw, so I would just leave it be. But the version of Shiro that we do see here, and no, it's not the same Shiro as Ilya's brother you meet in the first episode, who's kind of boring. But, sorry, Shiro. But he is a throwback to the original Shiro, while also being what a lot of fans would say extremely badass.
Hmm.
And it's amazing and fantastic and wonderful, and it requires very much so understanding the world that Prisma Ilya has built and the canon that they build from the second season onward to understand. So if you like really badass fights and complicated magic and a lot of angst, I say go for it. But again, like the problematic stuff, especially season two. Oh my god, no. Season two. There's an entire character who, yeah, let's just say it gets pretty cringy.
Interesting. I'm definitely curious. I'm definitely going to eventually watch the rest of the franchise and stuff, but how would you say, like, the problematic elements kind of compare between this series and, like, the main Fate Stay Night?
Oh, wow. Good question. I think Prisma Ilya is worse.
Oh, okay.
Fate Stay Night has some problematic stuff, of course. It does, quote-unquote, help that the characters are older.
Hmm.
Of course, before you play the visual novel, they say, oh, all the characters here are age 18 plus. That's obviously not true. Anyone who's been to a Japanese high school knows that if you are year two in high school, unless you've been held back, you are not 18.
Hmm.
And then, of course, the youngest of the main cast, Sakura, is a first year student. So unless she's been held back a lot, there's no way she's 18.
Ugh.
So yes, of course, they're underage. But there's a big joke about the sexual elements in Fate Stay Night, where the H scenes, I guess you could say, they're really poorly written.
Hmm.
And them being poorly written is almost, I wouldn't say it makes it tolerable, but it adds like that layer of disbelief that makes it easier to deal with.
Hmm.
Because it's so badly written, it's just like, okay, all right, okay. You have fun now. But then when you're watching the anime for Prilia, it's like in your face. And it's not bad writing. It's just happening.
Hmm.
And there's no way to turn away from it other than to look away from your screen. There's no, it's so bad, it's hilarious. There's no knee slapping. Ha ha ha, I can't believe this is a real thing somebody wrote. It's a, oh my god, I can't believe this is a real thing that's happening. And you just kind of have to sit there and deal with it if you want to endure the rest of the series. And the worst part is some of that stuff is so well animated that you're sitting there like, how much of the budget did they bust doing on this super problematic scene? I was like, whoa, that's really detailed. Whoa. Like, it did not go into straight NSFW, but it's enough where if I were watching this and somebody came in the room and they did not know what I was watching and they saw this, I would feel such horrible embarrassment. I'd chuck myself out the window. That's how cringy it can be.
Yeah, that's very fair. I was like, oh, this is a show, yeah, I can only possibly watch when I'm home alone. No one else can know I'm watching this show, which is not necessarily a ringing endorsement.
Yeah. No.
Yeah. But I still feel like it's so weird, because it's like there's this heavy layer of perversion, but if you just peel it back, then you get a decent show. Like, it's just really hard to watch. But it's, you know, again, it's just like, I would you know, recommend any adults who want to have, you know, more of a scope of understanding of, like, Magical Girl parodies to check this one out, maybe. But, yeah, I'm definitely kind of concerned about the additional character I think I know that you're talking about before, based on, like, advertising and stuff. Because, like, this year being the 10th anniversary, there is, like, a lot of merchandising and, you know, all these kind of promotional events. And it's this thing where it's, like, even just looking at, like, the merchandise, it's, like, most of it is stuff that, like, I would not be comfortable having anyone look at. And it's, like, I mean, I think they finally showed one where, like, the girls are in dresses that actually cover their whole body. Because, like, we didn't even get into it. Like, Ilya's outfit is pretty okay, except for, like, the way she's illustrated, like, kind of outlines her breasts a bit too much when she's transformed.
Oh, yeah.
And then with Miu's outfit, like, hers is, like, kind of got that underwear thing going on, like, almost like a leotard or whatever, which is, just makes everything that she's doing a panty shot, which is not good, because she's, again, also very young. And she's also got, like, a lot of mystery to her, because we didn't talk about it, but we do get to see the flashback of when, you know, Luvia discovers her already transformed. Like, we don't know exactly what transpired between her and Sapphire in this season anyway, but we see that, like, she is already, you know, very ready to be a magical girl. And she, all she asks is to have a home and, you know, like, just to be taken care of, basically. Which, yeah, just there's, it leaves a lot of, you know, mystery to her, which is interesting. And, you know, her personality doesn't really change very much. So, like, even at the very end, she's still like, yeah, I'm only friends with Ilya. I'm really glad to have this friend, but I'm not going to be friends with anyone else. And it's a problem for Ilya, who wants to be friends with everyone.
Yes.
It's an interesting dynamic. And I don't know, is Miu also a character from the original?
No, she's not. She is unique to Prisma Ilya.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Hmm. Yeah,
I was she is the canon that. Foreigner, so to speak. I guess you could say, quoting TV tropes.
Interesting. Yeah, TV tropes has some interesting names for tropes, and
oh yeah.
Okay, I guess I could see where that comes from, but yeah. Do you think? I guess as far as like the Fate fandom is concerned, do you think there are a lot of people that from the main fandom like actually got into Prisma Ilya, or do you think there's like a larger percentage of people who are not familiar with Fate that have also gotten into the series?
I think it's both, but I think it's mainly people who started out in Fate, in my opinion. I mean, because all of us, when I was more into the fandom, and a lot of my online friend circles at the time were in the Fate fandom, it was mainly people who already were familiar with Fate getting into it. And that was like the heyday of Fate, like the height of it, because we had just finished the Fate Zero adaptation, which started in 2011. And then Prisma Ilya came, and in 2014, they had the adaptation of Unlimited Blade Works. Well, we knew Unlimited Blade Works was going to happen. And so there was all kinds of hype for it. But because of Fate Zero, especially, the presence of Fate online especially was starting to grow. And I think the combination of Fate Zero and then, of course, Carnival Phantasm. Carnival Phantasm was around the same time. And Rin's magical girl outfit is actually not originally from Prisma Ilya. It's from, I believe, Fate Hall Ataraxia, and there's also a video game where it appears. So this is not Ruby's first appearance either.
Oh, okay.
We see the Kaleidos stick in Fate Hall Ataraxia, which is the visual novel that comes after Fate Stay Night. So the concept of the magical stick Ruby has already been in Fate for quite some time before Prisma Ilya became a thing, I do believe, if I'm remembering anything chronologically correctly. If I'm not, and you're out there listening to me, Fate fan, I'm sorry. But from what I do remember, Hall Ataraxia came first, and that's the first time we saw Rin as her alter ego, which was called Kaleido Ruby.
Huh. Is Kaleido Ruby, like, kind of a magical girl character, would you say?
She is a transformation that Rin undergoes with the Kaleido stick that she got from Zelrech, who is the same guy that, I guess, is sending them on this mission in the in Prismalia, if I remember correctly. It's Zelrech also. Zelrech is a really big guy in the Fate universe. He's like one of the most powerful sorcerers ever. So Luvia and Rin are competing for Zelrech's like approval. They both want to be his star pupil, his star, I guess, a magist in training. And it's through her connection with Zelrech that she gets Kaleido Ruby. Well, Zelrech has a sense of humor. He always has had one. And so it can be argued that Rin got Kaleido Ruby, got Ruby the stick in Haldraxia as kind of a joke. Of course, she doesn't know this. She's taking it seriously, and she wants to impress her master, so she takes it anyway, and it just messes with her. So this thing that was a gag to mess with Rin and turn her into a magical girl, now, of course, advanced itself and became the premise for Prismalia.
Huh. Does Ruby have, like, the same personality also in that one?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Definitely.
Okay, because, yeah, that's one thing I forgot to mention is, like, Ruby is very much a pervert herself. Like,
God, yeah.
And it's established that, like, Ruby and Sapphire are also somehow siblings, even though they're, like, magical inanimate objects. But basically, they are siblings, and Sapphire, you know, calls Ruby her big sister. And again, in episode 7, where a lot of madness happens, you know, they have to relay that information about, like, Ilya transforming in a different way and using that card and everything when Ruby wasn't around. And so she, like, basically uses a cord and plugs into Ruby, and Ruby acts like this is, like, a sexual act, and it's really uncomfortable, especially, again, because apparently they are somehow sisters. And so it's just, like, this weird... Yeah, just a really weird character choice, but I guess if that's what she already was like, that does make sense. But yeah, it was kind of rough. And, oh, I was kind of wondering, Rin and or Luvia, like, do they have any sort of connection to Ilya in the main series?
Yes, Rin was one of the Seven Masters of the Holy Grail War, and so was Ilya. So they met each other trying to kill each other, originally, rather have their servants kill each other.
Huh.
Rin was the master of Archer. And you saw the Archer card, of course, in the main series. And Ilya was the master of Berserker.
Oh. That makes sense. So I guess when you say masters, like, they are kind of summoning these creatures through these cards? Am I understanding that correctly?
In the original, it wasn't a card. They actually summoned the servant themselves.
Oh, okay.
So, like, the cards are, like, have the essence of the servants in them, which obviously you can then plug the card into Ruby or Sapphire, and then you have that servant's abilities, which I thought was very cool, by the way. But in the original, they're literally summoning these heroes through time and space to come and fight. And they have contracts between the master and the servant. And usually a servant has to rely on their master. It's kind of like D&D, where each servant has their own stats. And Nasu did use, like, chaotic good and other alignments, which that's a really big gag, because Gilgamesh, who I don't think you've met yet. No, I don't know, you haven't met Gilgamesh. Gilgamesh was mentioned as, I believe, chaotic good, and he is anything but good. Chaotic, yes, but good, no. The Phantom was kind of like, what was Nasu on when he gave Gilgamesh that particular alignment? But I lost my train of thought, but basically the servants are coming through time and space to fight in the Holy Grail War, to try and get the Holy Grail. In this case, they're not servants in that regard. They haven't been summoned through time and space. It's their essence that has been captured in the card instead.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I just wanted to... And again, clarify, because I know I'm someone who doesn't know a lot about Fate. I think a lot of listeners will also likewise be a little, yeah, maybe it's just as clueless as I am. But yeah, goodness, I think that's everything we had to talk about, unless you have any other thoughts about the first season or the franchise as a whole.
No, I think I'm okay. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course. So that in that case, we can get to the final question, which is, Neen, do you have a magical persona for yourself?
No. No, not really, unfortunately. I'm not that cool. If you consider me being able to put kimono on by myself a magical persona, then sure. But other than that, not really, no.
That is very impressive, yes.
Thank you, though.
So if you had the chance, like if you could imagine the Prismalia of your life, the spinoff in which you could become a magical girl in another universe, what do you think that would play out like?
Oh my goodness. If I were in Prismalia or any magical girl universe?
Oh, like if there was suddenly like a magical girl Neen show or whatever, like you were suddenly in a franchise starring yourself as a magical girl.
Oh my God. That's a really good question. If I were a magical girl, I don't know. I think I would be a very strange mix of Sailor Mars and Sailor Neptune with a dash of Moon somehow.
Interesting.
It's very hard to explain. I mean, I have trained as a Miko here in Osaka. I do go to Miko school. I'm not finished yet. I'd like to be hopefully soon. So there's that part, which I guess is a nod to Sailor Mars. I love the ocean. I've always loved the ocean. I love music. I've been trained in classical singing since I was 9. And I'm not saying I'm the greatest, but I have training. I know technically what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And I love food and sleeping. So I guess I'd be a weird combination of them. And I'm not so sure what my weapon would be. But I hope I have a lot of heart. That's all I hope.
One of the more important factors of being a magical girl, for sure.
Yeah. Definitely.
Great. So, yes, Neen, thank you so much for coming on to Sparkleside Chats.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Where can people find you and follow you online to talk to you about Prismalia and other, I guess, Fate series?
My kimono account is Mainichi Kimono, which is where I talk mainly about kimono. I am sometimes active on Twitter, on Fujikake Rin. Sometimes talk about Japan on there, and sometimes I just talk about how cute my students are. So if you'd like to follow me, that's great.
Awesome. So yes, those links will be in the show notes. But yeah, thank you again, and I hope you have a good rest of your day.
You too. Thank you so much.
Whether this was your first or last time listening, thank you so much for checking out this episode of Sparkleside Chats with Magical Girl Ayu. We hope you check out the rest of our chats, over 2 years of magical content and counting. And if you like what you heard, tell a friend, or tell 5 friends, or tell the whole world by talking about us online. If you use social media, don't forget to use the hashtag SparkleSideChats when talking about and sharing the podcast. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at MagicalGirlAyu, spelled A-Y-U, and you can find me at AyuShinos, AyuShekNows. You can also email us at sparklesidechats@gmail.com. Did you know we also take recommendations for future guests and topics? Just fill out the form in the show notes. You can even suggest yourself if you're so bold. The very best free way to support the podcast is using your podcast platform to give a rating and review of our little show. This gives the big internet machines the message that they should share it with more people, and I think we all want that, don't we? You can also join the Discord server for this podcast to talk about magical girls 24/7, often chatting directly with me and both previous and upcoming guests of the podcast. The forever link is in the show notes as well as on the socials, so be sure to stop by. Show notes can be found on your podcast platform of choice or at our main landing page at anchor.fm/sparkleside. If you have a few bucks, You can give a one-time donation at ko-fi.com or ko-fi.com/ayushinos. You can also commit to a monthly membership, which grants you access to bonus episodes about Magical Girls and adjacent content such as movies, comics, and other series that Magical Girl fans tend to also love. All it takes is $5 a month, but if you want to rank up, that'll give you discounts on art commissions and monthly requests as well. Music credits, as always, are also in the show notes. Original podcast music is by Hazel. You can find her on Twitter at A Few Bruises. Thanks again for listening, and remember, you are magical, forever and always. See you next time!